Welcome to the Best Science Medicine Podcast, BS without the BS. Hi, everyone, and welcome to the 477th episode of the Best Science Medicine Podcast. My name is James McCormack, and I'm a professor with the Faculty of Pharmaceutical Sciences at the University of British Columbia.
I'm Mike Allen. I'm a family doctor and the director of practice support at the College of Family Physicians of Canada, and I'm also an adjunct professor at the University of Alberta. Today, we're going to hit a very topical topic, and we're also bringing in a guest speaker, someone who has a lot of experience in this area and is also a relatively new peer group member. So, Jen, why don't you introduce yourself?
Hi. I'm Jen Potter. I'm a family physician in Winnipeg, Manitoba. I am an assistant professor at the University of Manitoba.
Excellent. And you've not been on the podcast before.
I have not.
Yeah. And Jen's just finished. We're going to do a couple podcasts with Jen in regards to obviously a couple of topics. And we're going to primarily start off with talking about vaccine hesitancy. And the title of the Tools of Practice is Vaccine Hesitancy in the Office, What Can I Do? And you wrote this with Adrian Lindbad, who's been on the podcast before.
That's right.
Yeah. And why did you guys decide to do it? Like, where did all that come from? I mean, I kind of get it, but there's a big issue out there with vaccine hesitancy right now.
You know, it really is a big issue. The WHO decided that vaccine hesitancy was one of their top 10 world global health threats in 2019. And then that was even before there was a global pandemic. And, so with vaccines being in the news all the time these days, you know, there's a lot of people with a lot of questions.
Yeah. No, that's something I didn't realize it was that, like, even before the pandemic came out, that it was even being considered that much of a problem. But yeah. So what did you guys find? What did you look for?
Well, we spent our time in this tool focusing on randomized controlled trials, and we focused on interventions that people can actually do in the office. There's a lot of things that are out there that are observational studies, or they require like a specific educational program or something like that. Those aren't necessarily the most accessible things for your average family doc in the office. So we sort of focused on the things that we can actually sort of put into practice tomorrow. And it turns out there's not that much.
Yeah.
not a surprise, though, but still there is some good information here, I think, from my read-through of the evidence even before the Tools for Practice.
Yeah, I think there's some things we can definitely do that do make a difference. We kind of found three main RCTs that we focused on in the tool. The first one sort of looked at interventions that were either aimed at educating people about disease risk or about correcting disinformation related to autism or control. And this study just looked at vaccine attitude scores. It didn't look at vaccine uptake. Unfortunately, none of them did. And it did find that one of the pearls you can take home from this study is that focusing on the disease risk, focusing on the dangers of measles, mumps, and rubella, instead of focusing on the autism concerns, really does seem to move the needle a little bit, not a lot, but it moves the needle more than anything else. So that was actually really interesting, I thought, because, it sort of seems like intuitive that we would, cut out these, try and deal with these worries that people have about autism, but it actually doesn't really seem to make that much of a difference.
And yeah, go ahead, Mike.
I was just saying, I remember years ago when I was faced with this and I hadn't looked at the literature around hesitancy, I was blown away by how terrible the information was around autism. And I desperately wanted that to set the record straight, if you were. and I put a lot of effort into that. I even wrote a Tools for Practice, an early Tools for Practice on that, about how there is no connection with autism, et cetera. And yet, really, I was coming at it from the wrong way. If I really wanted to change attitudes, I should have talked about the threats that measles, mumps, and rubella represent, rather than trying to refute the original highly biased, and it's hard to even call it research. That article was later pulled, but it's just our nature, I think, to want to correct things that are mistakes or incorrect information, but it's actually not the way to go about this. It just further alienates people, I think.
It does. And actually, the second study we talked about in the tool really illustrates that, because what this second study really looked at, different types of messaging. One, again, was the debunking the autism risk. Another was education about measles, mumps, rubella. They also talked about a story of a sick child, and then also some visual images. So they really sort of approached this MMR angle from a number of different ways. And they didn't really find any of that helped. But there was a subgroup in the group that really were sort of most opposed to vaccines. They actually got worse when you talk to them about the autism risk. It really, what it did is it seemed to sort of get them to dig in their heels and kind of entrench their views. And so it actually did more harm than good to really focus on this autism risk in that particular study.
And that kind of makes sense, because what you're doing is you're arguing against something that there's no evidence, relatively speaking. So it's a really difficult sort of argument to win, where I think it's a much more simple process to go. I think you can have a discussion about, what are the concerns about measles, mumps, and rubella, and you can ballpark come up with ideas of, what's the chances of those and how severe and all that sort of stuff is. But the other one is, the autism link is, how do you debate it other than to say, all the evidence is crap and what do we do about it?
Yeah, I mean, it's more than that, though, James. It's not just that the original evidence is crap. The subsequent evidence, it's cohort, of course.
Yeah.
But the cohort studies are darn strong. I mean, basically all of Denmark.
Yeah, no. What I meant is, if you're coming in with a belief that it causes autism.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
That you've gotten that from the previous,
Yeah, you've gotten that from a website.
Exactly. Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I know that I'm aware there's, very good cohort data, but it's you're trying to argue against something that is almost entrenched and very difficult to get around. And there's so many things in life like this that, you have a belief in whether it be, politics or religion or whatever. It's a very difficult thing to go against, even if you do have, like you said, the good evidence.
Well, we've looked at that. I'll just say that we talked about that last time, James, with how people, when you actually give them information that is against their core belief, instead it strengthens their belief. It doesn't erode it at all. Mm-hmm. Information is not the answer to changing someone's opinion.
Yeah.
And Jen, I think sorry to interrupt. Please go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that the things you talked about, politics, religion, and these days, opinions on vaccination, mm-hmm. these really kind of come into people's core identities, right? And so if you have somebody who comes into your office and they've got this belief that's sort of, neutral or negative towards vaccines, and then you kind of give them this information that conflicts with what they, the way they see the world, now you've set up this cognitive dissonance, right? It mm-hmm. it doesn't ring true to them, and it makes them kind of get their back up, right? And we respond to threats the same way, right? And so this feels like a threat in people's minds, not consciously, of course, but that's how they see it. And so then what happens is that they tend to sort of shut down, and they tend to not be receptive to what you're saying. And so you can actually sort of do damage to your relationship as well as get them entrenched. So it's sort of one of those things that it seems like it should work, but it really doesn't.
Yeah. And at least these two sort of randomized controlled trials show that you can't change them off that autism thing with regards to the vaccine issue of harm. But we might be able to shift them a bit if we talk about why we're vaccinating them in the first place, I guess.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly. Focus on the benefits.
Yeah, and then so those were the first two trials, and then there was one last trial that looked at this of I think about sort of an and all of these actually I think were online studies, and this was in what about 800 participants, and they were randomized to sort of different information as well.
Yeah, so the third study, it was like you say, about 800 participants. Everybody got information about MMR, about measles, mumps, and rubella. Mm-hmm. And then there were three other groups, and one group got information, that same information, but they also got information on the benefits of the vaccination to the child. Another group got the information on measles, mumps, rubella, plus information on the benefits to society of the vaccine. And then one group got all three components. So the information on MMR, as well as the benefits to child and the benefits to society. And when they looked at, again, this was a vaccine hesitancy scale that looked at intention to vaccinate. Really, the only thing that moved the needle there was the two arms that talked about the benefits of vaccination to the child, to the individual child. If they just talked about the benefits to society, or if they didn't talk about it at all, it didn't move the needle at all.
So it turns out, Jen, that we care about our own kids more than we care about society.
It turns out.
Yeah. But and you could have probably predicted that. I mean, you know, you're going at, you know, the, you know, while I think, you know, we're in a state right now that is very, very unusual. But I think, you know, if you go in there and you know, it is about what can I do to protect me and my family and all that sort of stuff. You know, if you happen to then protect other people as well, great. But I think it would be interesting. I would say a good chunk of people are coming in and getting vaccinations, not necessarily for society, but for themselves. Although I'm sure there's a blend.
I'm sure there is too. And, I mean, you think about it when you're a parent, like that kind of makes sense, right? You know, we think about benefits to society as, you know, practitioners, but you know, if you're a parent, you know, you've got this child and this child is maybe the center of your universe, right? You've got this 2-month-old baby who's coming in for their very first vaccines. You've gotten terrible sleep for the last how many months? You know, your entire world is this child. They just started smiling at you and things like that. And, you know, so really this is, I can see where parents are coming from. I can see why the focus for them is really on their own child.
Well, because, and what you're doing is you're taking an otherwise healthy person and giving them something. And I think that's the concern is that, you know, if for sure we knew there was zero risk, period, then I don't think people would have much of an issue. But it's that, you know, potential for you know, a side effect associated with it, when in fact, you know, they're not coming in for treatment, they're coming in there for prevention. So I think that may be the process. If we knew for sure that they are 100% safe, I don't think anyone would have a problem with it.
But absolutely, we erode that belief, right? We like the there are energies in the world, like there are efforts in this world to kind of erode that belief that that they're safe.
Yeah.
And it's fascinating. We talked about some of the mental. There was a study done in 2018 that asked 1,300 adults their knowledge of vaccines and autism, and around a third of adults felt that they knew more than doctors and scientists about the relationship between vaccines and autism. Yeah. A third.
Yeah.
So how do you go up against that? And the ones. And the most strong, those who actually scored when they were surveyed, the poorest on knowledge, were the ones most confident about their ability. And then that's the Dunning-Kruger effect, but it's fascinating. So how do you sway them? So when you, then we know all about how if you try and sway someone's opinion from older literature, that you just, as we talked about earlier, you just push them into a direction that's opposite of the one you want. But at least I think what this tells us, Jen, is that there are three studies all pointing to a similar theme of how we should approach people.
Yeah, exactly. And I think what it comes down to is, you know, focus on the benefits and focus on the benefits to the individual in front of you. There are some other, you know, less rigorous like cohort studies and things like that that talk about, you know, making sure you actually make a strong recommendation to get the vaccine. That seems to help as well. And there's lots of information out there that demonstrates that people really do want information from their family physicians, and they really do trust their family physicians, you know, as a source of, you know, of information on vaccinations. But again, it's a range, right? There's some people who will not believe anything you say, and then there's some people who are much more receptive.
So you've now gone through all of the, at least the decent evidence that we can find in regards to, you know, what can we do about vaccine hesitancy. Has it changed what you do, or have you sort of modified what you did in the past, or, you know, what do you do now when you find people come in and you can notice that there's clearly vaccine hesitancy?
Yeah. So the first thing I do is I really just try and keep the conversation open, right? I try to, you know, I try to sort of explore what their specific concerns are. for some people, it is autism, right? And mm-hmm. for that person, maybe I would make a comment about the evidence about autism, but I wouldn't spend a lot of time on it. I tend to try and explore with them what exactly they've heard and what their what their belief system is, and if there's a little bit of like a gentle sort of correction I can put in there, that's what I'll do.
Right.
But then really what I try to do as quickly as possible is really pivot to, okay, but let's talk about, you know, the pertussis outbreaks or the measles outbreaks that we're seeing now, and let's make sure that little Susie is protected here.
Yeah. And I'd have thought just even the, you know, sort of the question of, you know, tell me what you know about measles. Tell me what you believe mumps is, or because I would imagine a lot of people don't really even know what they are and what the potential consequences are. All they are focused on that, that there may be some harm.
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of people have the idea that these are just sort of natural childhood illnesses and everybody kind of gets through them. And unfortunately, that's really not the case. And so I think that, exactly. Pivoting to talking about what these things are is a good idea. I mean, everybody kind of these days knows what autism is, right? But nobody really knows what polio looks like. So it's hard to see that as the threat.
Yeah. And go ahead, Mike.
I was going to say that it's been said before that, you know, vaccines are kind of a victim of their own success mm-hmm. because it's hard to be a concerned or afraid or even knowledgeable about something that we don't see anymore, just as you indicated with polio. So the idea that we don't know nearly as many kids, I said a little while ago, I haven't actually seen a case of measles because the way they break out, if you're not in the area of the breakout, you just don't see them. And if mm-hmm. I have a small practice volume. So because vaccines are so successful, they've reduced the numbers of these diseases. And then people think, well, they're not really around anymore. I don't need to be afraid of them. And it's kind of this, you know, they're a victim of their own success. And we have to kind of remind ourselves the reason we're not seeing them, the reason you're not so concerned about them, but you know a kid at your child's school who has autism. So that's sticking out in your mind, but not the measles and mumps and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's an interesting paradox that we put ourselves in.
And right now we're specifically talking about childhood vaccinations, but we're fully aware of other vaccinations. Like, I mean, we could even talk about, within the flu vaccine, which is something that in theory you'd be getting it every year, although this year, I'm not sure if everyone knows this, but like the incidence of the flu worldwide is, I think it's close to zero.
It's close to zero in a percent.
Yeah. Yeah,
zero. Just because it's less infectious than COVID, and by following the COVID restrictions, we've really reduced our risk of flu.
Yeah,
but COVID's another matter. Because it's much more contagious, it's still relatively prevalent wherever you are. Sometimes depending on where you are, sometimes very prevalent.
Yeah. Now, do you guys see much vaccine hesitancy around the flu shot?
Oh, I do.
I do. Yep. But I see it. I see less around COVID. But there are these subgroups of people now with some of the concerns of some of the vaccines. There's some more
hesitancy
arising. Yeah. And then there's always that subgroup. And I was going to ask Jen. You know, it's been said. You know, the vaccine hesitancy is one thing. But the true anti-vaxxer, the one that's at the extreme, that I have a quote that I use in talks that from one of these anti-vaxxer sites, that vaccines are like time bombs. You'll never know when is the next one's going to kill a child. It's just absolutely ridiculous. But it would, I've heard it said that it's you're wasting your time if you're trying to make headway with that group. How do you feel about that, Jen?
Well, I mean, I don't have a good way of convincing and persuading people when they're that entrenched in their views. And there just isn't really a good way that anybody's identified. Yeah. My best suggestion is try to keep the door open and try to keep the conversation going, right? So, you know, if you have a discussion about vaccines and they turn it down, you know, like, that's okay. You know, you want to stay non-judgmental. You want to keep them coming back, because if they come back, you can keep things going and maybe there's a chance maybe they'll change their mind. But if you really sort of shut them down or alienate them or you know, really kind of make them not want to come back, then the conversation is over and there's really no chance that they're ever going to change their mind.
Kind of like smoking, eh? When we have our patients who are smoking and they turn us down, you always try and, you know, come at it the next visit, especially when the visit's relevant. So they're in for a respiratory infection or something like that. So, yeah, I think your advice is good, that you don't call them ridiculous or any of those kind of things.
No.
But try and keep that conversation going. So, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say exactly the same analogy as smoking. He says, well, when you're ready, let me know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can provide a vaccine, or I can provide stuff for, you know, for smoke or to help you with smoking cessation and all that sort of stuff. And, you know, it's just sort of doing that. But I think, you know, let's talk about, there's a little bit about the flu vaccine. So I think one of the more, I don't know if it's useful, but we can give fairly decent numbers around the flu shot, you know, as far as benefit. You know, we know that roughly speaking, other than this year, you know, there's a 5 or 10% chance of getting the flu every year, and the vaccines are anywhere from what, about 40 to maybe 80% effective. So you can cut off about, you know, if it's 10%, you can cut that down by 4 or 5 or 6 cases, if you can.
And
and that's kind of what, those are the numbers that we're talking about when it comes to the flu shot. But so you can have that conversation. Now, I'm unaware of, do people, are they concerned about the flu shot and autism?
I don't see that. It's that it doesn't, it, Jen, you can tell us your experience, but in my experience is that I've done just fine without it. Or my favorite is, I got the flu shot 1 year and I had flu after it. So it was because of the flu shot, and I'll never get the flu shot again.
Yeah.
I've heard that way more than is statistically possible.
Yeah.
So I don't know, Joe, what are some of the things you've heard?
Yeah, my experience is very, very similar. The flu shot doesn't really work. The flu isn't really that bad. I never get the flu. Definitely the classic is, you know, I got the flu shot 1 year and then I was sick.
Yeah.
So there's some definite, common themes.
Yeah. And I think you can say, yeah, you know what, you're right about some of these things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if it's a 5% chance of the flu, most of the time you're not going to get the flu every year.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then you guys know as well as I do the mismatch between, you know, a bad cold and the flu and all that sort of stuff, about trying to figure those all out.
Yeah.
But sure. Now, what are you guys hearing primarily, or what are you seeing with people right now with regards to vaccine hesitancy and COVID? I mean, there really wasn't any evidence out there that you guys could find about that, Jen?
Nothing at the level of RCTs, no.
No, for sure.
The studies out there that I have found on the COVID vaccine are really tied to efficacy and safety, and not really to, you know, how to convince people. So when we talk about COVID vaccines, we're kind of trying to fall back to sort of the same principles that we use with the other vaccines.
Right. Of just talking about the numbers and what, which ones and so on.
And also the risk, right. Of getting, like, for example, the risk, and I actually don't know what the AstraZeneca clot risk is at the present time, but I thought it was somewhere around 1.5 million or something like that.
Yeah. And It varies depending on the population. I've seen it as low as like 1 in 100,000, and then you're right up to 1 in 1 million.
Yeah. So let's call it in the middle there somewhere, and then compare that to your risk of hospitalization at 5 to 10% for those who are symptomatic, and then, you know, 1 to 2% for death. That's 1 in 100 versus 1 in 5. 500,000. So
yeah, with no, but except Mike, you got to add in not everybody gets COVID. So you've got to,
absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. So in a terrible event, rates can sometimes go north of 10%, et cetera.
Yeah.
It's not, you're absolutely right. Then you have to balance all that in. So it's, you can see where the mind swims with these numbers though, right? Like, it's a bit confusing. And the vaccine is something you're choosing to do. The vaccine is something you're not choosing to do. Sorry, the vaccine is something you're choosing to do. Getting sick is you're not choosing. Mm-hmm. So it's you're weighting these things differently. And it's really, I sympathize to an extent about, you know, how do you work this messaging? Because I see public health doing their best right now. There was just a call, if you're from Canada, I'm sure there's ones in your countries that you're listening from, but there was a call today to public health trying to explain risks and benefits of the vaccines, given what we're learning now from them.
No, exactly. And I mean, it's, and the landscape changes so quickly, right?
Oh, goodness.
Yeah. And, you know, when you've got, you know, I'm trying to think, there's very few things. I mean, I guess you could go with the Zoster vaccine where there's a couple of versions of it. But we have some, you know, reasonably decent evidence that one is certainly better than the other, at least on a relative scale. And, you know, we have some of that data for the COVID vaccines, but it's a very tricky thing, especially and all the stuff to do with the blood clots. And it's a nightmare for trying to be clear and specific because we don't have that data.
And this is a different year too, right? Mm-hmm. This is a different event series, because when you look at the Zoster vaccine stuff, it's not getting the kind of uptake that these vaccines are so quickly. And so we're getting this massive influx of information with massive numbers that we can then start to examine exceptionally rare events.
Yeah.
Which we don't get generally with our other vaccines.
Yeah. And the big difference between the Zoster and COVID is that if you get Zoster, you're not transmitting it.
Yeah.
You know, so that the big issue with COVID is the transmission. I mean, if it was, you know, that's it makes it a fundamentally different conversation, I think.
Yeah, there's a lot more to discuss. It's tricky. And I'm glad you looked at what you did, Jen, because I think that information is very helpful for people. Like I said, early in my career, I approached this the wrong way. When I found out that what I needed to do more was focus on the conditions rather than trying to discredit or clarify bad information, that was a real epiphany for me, because I would have thought for sure I was doing it the right way, but I was doing it the wrong way.
Well, we live and learn, right?
Yeah. It never stops.
That's why they call it the practice of medicine.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah.
Oh, where would the fun in that be if you knew everything anyway?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, exactly. No, this is, I mean, if we knew everything, we could just put it into a computer and figure it out. That's why the whole evidence-based healthcare is not just about the evidence. It's about, you know, your clinical expertise and values and preferences and all that sort of stuff. And boy, all of those three things are in spades right now. For the COVID vaccine and you know, these are very difficult times to figure it out. And then you add the whole process of, you know, whether it's going to get, you know, I know people would hate, a lot of people would hate having it mandated, but it's going to be an interesting process about where you go with that. And I can see how, you know, I don't think anyone's going to mandate it, but you know, it's very tricky.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So anything else about vaccine hesitancy that you want to bring up, Jen? I think you've done a really good job of at least what we know about it from an RCT perspective. We sort of just sort of gone on about the different areas to think about how to educate or talk to people more than just educate about the different vaccines. Anything else you want to add, Mike?
No, I am good, James.
So I think we'll just leave it at that. So thanks as always for listening.
Talk to you later.
Bye-bye.